Chapter 82. That the souls of dumb animals are not immortal. From what has been said, it may be clearly proved that the souls of dumb animals are not immortal, for it has been already shown that no operation of the sensitive part can possibly be without the body. Now we cannot find in the souls of dumb animals any operation superior to those of the sensitive part, for they neither understand nor reason. This appears from the fact that all animals of the same species operate in the same way, as though moved by nature and not as operating by art. Thus every swallow builds its nest, and every spider spins its web, in the same way. Therefore the souls of dumb animals have no operation that is possible without the body. Since, then, every substance has some operation, the soul of a dumb animal cannot exist apart from the body. Therefore it perishes when the body perishes. Again, every form that is separate from matter is actually understood, for the active intellect makes species to be actually intelligible, in so far as it abstracts them, as appears from what has been said. But if the dumb animal's soul remains after its body has perished, it will be a form separate from matter. Therefore it will be a form actually understood. Now, in things separate from matter, that which understands is the same as that which is understood, as Aristotle says in Theoria Anima. Therefore the soul of a dumb animal, if it survive the body, will be intellectual, which is impossible. Again, in everything that is able to attain to a certain perfection we find a natural desire for that perfection, since good is what all desire, yet so that each thing desires the good proper to it. Now, in dumb animals we do not find a natural desire for perpetual existence, except as regards perpetuity of species, inasmuch as we find in them the desire for begetting whereby the species is perpetuated, which desire is found in both plants and inanimate things, but not as regards the appetite that is proper to an animal as such, which appetite is consequent upon apprehension. For, since the sensitive soul does not apprehend except here and now, it cannot possibly apprehend perpetual existence. Neither therefore does it desire it with animal appetite. Therefore the soul of a dumb animal is not capable of perpetual existence. Moreover, since pleasure's perfect operations, as Aristotle says in Ten Ethic, the operation of a thing is directed to that in which it takes pleasure as in an end. Now all pleasures of dumb animals are referred to the preservation of the body, for they delight not in sounds, perfumes, and sights, except in so far as they are indicative of foods or venereal matters, which are the objects of all their pleasures. Hence all their operations are directed to the preservation of their bodily existence, as their end. Therefore they have no existence apart from the body. The teaching of the Catholic faith is in keeping with this statement, for it is said Genesis 9, of the dumb animal's soul the life thereof is in the blood, as though to say its existence depends on the permanence of the blood. It is also said in the book De Ecclesiastici Dogmatibus, we declare that man alone has a subsistent soul, that is, which has life of itself, and that the souls of dumb animals perish with the body. Moreover, Aristotle says that the intellective part of the soul is distinguished from the other parts as incorruptible from corruptible. This puts out of court the opinion of Plato, who held that the souls even of dumb animals are immortal. And yet it would seem possible to prove that the souls of dumb animals are immortal, for if a thing has a per se operation belonging to itself, it also is self-subsistent. Now the sensitive soul in dumb animals has a per se operation wherein the body has no part, namely to move, because a mover is composed of two parts, one of which is mover and the other moved. Wherefore, since the body is something moved, it follows that the soul alone is mover. Therefore it is self-subsistent. Consequently, it cannot be corrupted accidentally when the body perishes, since those things alone are corrupted accidentally which have not per se being. Nor can it be corrupted per se, seeing that it has no contrary, nor is it composed of contraries. It follows therefore that it is altogether incorruptible. The argument of Plato, whereby he proved that every soul is immortal, would seem to come to the same as this, because, to wit, the soul moves itself, and whatever moves itself must needs be immortal. For the body dies not except when it is abandoned by that which moved it, and a thing cannot abandon itself, and consequently, according to him, that which moves itself cannot die. And so he concluded that every moving soul, even that of dumb animals, is immortal. We have said that this argument comes to the same as the preceding, because, since in Plato's opinion nothing moves unless it be moved, that which moves itself is a per se mover and therefore is a per se operation. Again, Plato held that the sensitive soul has an operation of its own, not only in moving but also in sensing. For he declared that sensation is a movement of the soul itself which senses, and that the soul, being moved thus, moved the body to sensation. Wherefore when he defined sense he said that it is the movement of the soul through the body. Now it is clear that these statements are false, for to sense is not to move, but to be moved, because from being potentially sentient the animal is made actually sentient through the sensible objects by which the senses are impressed. But it cannot be said that the sense is passive to the sensible in the same way as the intellect is passive to the intelligible object, so that sensation could be an operation of the soul without a bodily instrument, in the same way as understanding is. For the intellect apprehends things as abstracted from matter and material conditions, which are the principles of individuality, whereas the sense does not. This is evidenced by the sense being confined to particular objects, while understanding is of universals. It is therefore clear that the senses are passive to things as existing in matter, while the intellect is not, but according as they are subject to abstraction. Therefore the passion of the intellect is without corporeal matter, whereas the passion of the senses is not. Again, different senses are receptive of different sensibles: sight, for instance, of colors, hearing of sounds. Now this difference clearly arises from the different dispositions of the organs, for the organ of sight needs to be in potentiality to all colors, and the organ of hearing to all sounds. But if this reception took place without any corporeal organ, the same faculty would be receptive of all sensible objects, since an immaterial power, for its own part, stands in an equal relation to all such qualities. Wherefore the intellect, through not using a corporeal organ, takes cognizance of all sensible objects. Therefore there is no sensation without a corporeal organ. Further, sense is corrupted by excellence of its object, but the intellect is not, because he who understands higher objects of intelligence is able to understand others, not less but more. The passion caused in the sense by the sensible differs in kind from that which is caused in the intellect by the intelligible. The passion of the intellect occurring without a corporeal organ, while the passion of the sense is connected with a corporeal organ, the harmony of which is destroyed by the excellence of the sensible. Plato's statement that a soul moves itself may seem to be well founded by reason of what we observe in regard to bodies. For seemingly no body moves unless it is moved. Wherefore Plato said that every mover is moved. And since we cannot go on to infinity as though everything moved were moved by another, he stated that in each order the first mover moved itself. From this it followed that the soul, which is the first mover in the movement of animals, is something that moves itself. But this is shown to be false, on two counts. First, because it has been proved that whatever is moved per se is a body. Wherefore, since a soul is not a body, it is impossible for it to be moved save accidentally. Secondly, because, since a mover, as such, is in act, while the thing moved, as such, is in potentiality, and since nothing can be, in the same respect, in act and potentiality, it will be impossible for the same thing to be, in the same respect, mover and moved. But if a thing is stated to move itself, one part thereof must needs be mover and the other part moved. It is in this way that an animal is said to move itself, because the soul is mover and the body moved. Since, however, Plato did not hold that the soul is a body, although he made use of the word movement, which properly speaking belongs to bodies, he did not mean movement in this strict sense, but referred it in a more general way to any operation in which sense. Aristotle also says 3 de anima, that sensation and understanding are movements, but in this way movement is the act, not of that which is in potentiality, but of that which is perfect. Consequently, when he said that the soul moves itself, by this he meant to say that it acts without the help of the body, whereas it is the other way about with other forms which exercise no action apart from matter, for that which heats is not heat by itself but something hot. Hence he wished to conclude that every soul which causes movement is immortal, because that which has a per se operation must needs also have per se existence. But it has been already proved that the operation of the soul of a dumb animal, sensation to wit, cannot be without the body. And this is much more evident as regards its operation of appetite, because all things pertaining to the appetite of the sensitive faculty are manifestly accompanied by a certain bodily transmutation, and are known as passions of the soul. From this it follows that not even is movement an operation of the sensitive part without an organ. For the soul of a dumb animal moves not except through sense and appetite, because the power which is said to execute movement makes the members obedient to the command of the appetite, so that the body is perfected with powers directed to its being moved rather than with powers of moving. It is accordingly clear that no operation of the dumb animal's soul can be independent of the body, and from this we necessarily conclude that the dumb animal's soul perishes with the body. Chapter 83. That the human soul begins to exist with the body. Since, however, the same things are found to have both a beginning of being and an end of being, it may seem to someone that, since the human soul has no end of its being, neither has it had any beginning of being, but always has been. And seemingly this can be proved by the following arguments. For that which will never cease to be, has the power to be always. And that which has the power to be always, can never be truly said not to be, since a thing's duration in existence extends as far as its power to exist. Now of everything that is begun to be, it is at some time true to say that it is not. Therefore that which will never cease to be, at no time begins to be. Further, the truth of intelligibles is not only incorruptible, but, for its own part, is eternal, because it is necessary, and whatever is necessary is eternal, since for that which necessarily is, not to be is an impossibility. Now it is from the incorruptibility of intelligible truth that the soul is proved to have incorruptible being. Therefore by similar reasoning, from its eternity we can prove the eternity of the soul. Moreover, a thing is not perfect if it lacks several of its principal parts. Now it is clear that the principal parts of the universe are intellectual substances, to which genus, as shown above, human souls belong. Consequently, if every day as many human souls begin to exist as men are born, it is evident that many of its principal parts are added to the universe every day, and that it lacks many such parts. Therefore it follows that the universe is imperfect, which is impossible. Furthermore, some argue from the authority of Holy Writ, for it is stated Genesis I, that on the seventh day God ended his work which he had made, and he rested from all his work which he had done. But this would not be so, if he made new souls every day. Therefore new human souls do not begin to exist, but they have existed from the beginning of the world. For these, then, and like reasons some, supposing the world to be eternal, have said that as the human soul is incorruptible, so has it existed from eternity. Hence those, namely the Platonists, who maintained that human souls in their universality are immortal, held that they have also existed from eternity, and are united to bodies at one time, at another separated from them, this vicissitude depending on certain fixed periods of years. On the other hand, those who maintained that human souls are immortal in respect of some one thing which remains over from all men after death, held that this same one thing has existed from eternity, whether it be the active intellect alone, as Alexander said, or, besides this, the passive intellect, as Averroes asserted. This too is apparently the meaning of Aristotle's words, since, speaking of the intellect, he says that it is not only incorruptible, but also perpetual. Some, however, professing the Catholic faith, yet imbued with the teachings of the Platonists, have held a middle course. For since, according to the Catholic faith, nothing is eternal besides God, they maintained, not that human souls are eternal, but that they were created with or rather before the visible world, and yet are united anew to bodies. Of those who professed the Christian faith, Origen was the first to hold this opinion, and afterwards several followed him. In fact, this opinion survives to this day among heretics, of whom the Manichees agree with Plato in asserting the eternity and transmigration of souls. But it can be easily proved that the foregoing opinions are not founded upon truth, for we have already shown above, that there is not but one possible or active intellect for all. Wherefore it remains for us to proceed against those opinions which state that there are many human souls, but that they existed before bodies, either from eternity or from the formation of the world. This would seem unreasonable for the following reasons. For it was shown above, that the soul is united to the body as its form and act. Now although act is naturally prior to potentiality, yet in one and the same subject it is posterior to it in time, since a thing is moved from potentiality to act. Wherefore the seed that is potentially living precedes the soul, which is the act of life. Again, it is natural to every form to be united to its proper matter, else that which is made of form and matter would be something beside nature. Now that which is becoming to a thing according to nature is ascribed to it before that which is becoming thereto beside nature, since what becomes a thing beside nature is in that thing accidentally, whereas what is becoming to it according to nature is in it per se, and that which is accidental always comes after that which is per se. Therefore it is becoming to the soul to be united to the body before being separated from the body. Therefore it was not created before the body to which it is united. Moreover, every part that is separated from its whole is imperfect. Now the soul, since it is a form, as proved above, is a part of the human species. Consequently, as long as it exists by itself apart from the body, it is imperfect. But the perfect precedes the imperfect in the order of natural things. Therefore it is not becoming to the order of nature that the soul should have been created apart from the body before being united to the body. Moreover, if souls were created without their bodies, we must inquire how they came to be united to those bodies. For this was either by force or by nature. If by force, since whatever is the result of force is against nature, it follows that the union of soul and body is unnatural. Wherefore man, who is composed of both, is something unnatural, and this is clearly false. Moreover, intellectual substances are of a higher order than heavenly bodies. Now nothing violent or contrary is to be found in heavenly bodies, much less, therefore, is there in intellectual substances. On the other hand, if souls are united to bodies naturally, it follows that as soon as they were created, souls had a natural desire to be united to bodies. Now the natural appetite is forthwith brought into act unless there be an obstacle, as instanced in the movement of heavy and light bodies, because nature always works in the same way. Consequently, from the very moment of their creation they would have been united to bodies unless there was something to prevent it. But everything that hinders the realization of the natural appetite does violence thereto. Therefore it was by violence that at some time souls were separate from bodies. Now this is unreasonable, both because in such substances there can be nothing violent, as we have proved, and because the violent and the unnatural, since they are accidental, cannot precede that which is according to nature, nor can they be consequent upon the whole species. Further, since everything naturally desires its own perfection, it is for matter to desire form and not vice versa. Now the soul is compared to the body as form to matter, as was shown above. The union of the soul and body answers to the desire not of the soul but rather of the body. If, however, it be said that both are natural to the soul, namely union with the body and separation from the body, according to different times this is seemingly impossible, because changes that occur naturally in a subject are accidental, such as youth and old age. Hence if union with and separation from the body are natural changes as regards the soul, union with the body will be an accident of the soul, and consequently the man resulting from this union will not be a per se but an accidental being. Further, whatever is subject to alteration according to a difference of time is subject to the heavenly movement, which the whole course of time follows. Whereas intellectual and incorporeal substances, among which are separate souls, are above the whole order of bodies, wherefore they cannot be subject to heavenly movements. Therefore it is impossible for them that, according to a difference of time, they should be naturally, now united, now separated, or desire naturally this at one time, and that at another. If, however, it be said that they are united to bodies neither by violence nor by nature, but by deliberate choice, this is impossible, for no one wishes to come to a worse state except he be deceived. Now the separate soul is of a higher state than when united to the body, especially according to the Platonists, who say that through being united to the body it forgets what it knew before and is balked in the pure contemplation of truth. Therefore it is not willingly united to the body except it be deceived. But there cannot be in the soul any cause of deception, since according to them it is supposed to have all knowledge. Nor can it be said that its judgment in a particular matter of choice, proceeding from its universal knowledge, is upset on account of the passions, as happens in the incontinent, because passions of this kind are not without a bodily alteration, so that they cannot be in the separate soul. It remains therefore that if the soul existed before the body, it would not be united to the body of its own will. Further, any effect resulting from the concurrence of two mutually independent wills, is a casual effect. For instance, when a person intent on buying meets his creditor on the marketplace without the latter having agreed with him to go there. Now the will of the begetter, on which the begetting of the body depends, is not dependent on the will of the separate soul which desires to be united. Since then the union of soul and body cannot take place without the concurrence of both wills, it follows that such union is casual, so that the begetting of a man is not from nature but from chance, which is clearly false, since it results in the majority of cases. And again, if it be said that the soul is united to the body not from nature, nor of its own will, but by divine ordinance, this also seems inadmissible, if souls were created before bodies. For God fashioned each thing according to a manner becoming its nature. Hence it is said of each creature, God seeing that it was good, and of all together God saw all things that he had made, and they were very good. Consequently, if he created souls separate from bodies, we must needs say that this manner of being is more becoming their nature. Now, it is not in keeping with the ordinance of the divine goodness to bring things down to a lower state, but rather to raise them to a better. Therefore it could not have been by divine ordinance that the soul was united to the body. Further, it is not in keeping with the order of divine wisdom to raise up lower things to the detriment of higher. Now bodies that are subject to generation and corruption obtain the lowest place in the order of things. Therefore it was not becoming the order of divine wisdom to raise up human bodies by uniting pre-existing souls to them, since this could not be done without detriment to the latter, as proved from what has been said. Origen took note of this, and since he maintained that human souls were created from the beginning, he said that they were united to bodies by divine ordinance, but as a punishment. For he was of opinion that they had sinned before bodies were formed, and that according to the gravity of their sin they were enclosed in bodies more or less noble as in so many prisons. But this opinion cannot stand, because punishment is something contrary to a good of nature, and for this reason is said to be evil. If, therefore, the union of soul and body is something penal, it is not a good of nature. Yet this is impossible, for it is intended by nature, since it is the end of natural generation. Moreover, it would follow that to be a man is not good according to nature, whereas it is said after the creation of man God saw all the things that he had made, and they were very good. Further, good does not result from evil except by accident. Consequently, if it was appointed that the soul should be united to the body on account of a sin of the separate soul, since this union is a good, it follows that it is accidental. Therefore it was by chance that man was made. But this is derogatory to divine wisdom, whereof it is said that it ordered all things in number, weight, and measure. This is also clearly opposed to the teaching of the apostle, for it is said of Jacob and Esau, that when they were not yet born, nor had done any good or evil, it was said that the elder shall serve the younger. Therefore, before this was said, their souls had not committed any sin, and yet this was said after their conception, as appears from Genesis 25:23. When we were treating of the distinction of things, we adduced against the position of Origen several arguments, which may also be employed here. Wherefore, omitting them, let us pass on to others. Again, we must admit that the human soul either needs the senses, or not. Now experience would seem to make it clear that it needs the senses, because whoever lacks a certain sense, has no knowledge of the sensibles that are known through that sense. Thus one born blind has neither knowledge nor any understanding whatever of colors. Moreover, if the soul need not the senses in order to understand, we should not find in man any relation between sensitive and intellective knowledge. Yet we observe the contrary, for sensation leads to memories, and these lead us to take observation of things, whereby we arrive at the understanding of the universal principles of sciences and arts. If the human soul needs the senses in order to understand, since nature fails no thing in what is necessary for the accomplishment of its proper operation, thus it supplies with fitting organs of sense and movement those animals which are animated with the powers of sense and movement, the human soul must not have been fashioned without the necessary assistance of the senses. But the senses are inoperative without corporeal organs, as shown above. The soul was not made without the organs of the body. If, however, the human soul does not need the senses in order to understand, and for this reason is said to have been created apart from the body, we are compelled to say that before being united to the body, it understood by itself all scientific truths. In fact, the Platonists granted this, when they held that ideas, which in Plato's opinion are the separate intelligible forms of things, are the cause of knowledge. Wherefore the separate soul, since there was no obstacle in the way, received full knowledge of all sciences. We must therefore say, since it is found to be ignorant when united to the body, that it forgets the knowledge it had previously. The Platonists grant this also, and allege as a proof of this that however ignorant a man may be, if he be questioned methodically about things that are taught in the sciences, he will answer the truth. Thus, if a man has forgotten some of the things which he knew before, and someone suggests to him consecutively the things which he has forgotten, he recalls them to his memory. Whence it also followed that to learn is nothing else than to remember. Accordingly it follows, as a necessary consequence of this opinion, that union with the body hinders the soul from understanding. Now nature does not unite a thing to that which causes an obstacle to its operation, rather does it unite it to that whereby its operation is rendered more prompt. Consequently the union of body and soul will not be natural, and so man will not be a natural thing, nor will his generation be natural, which statements are clearly false. Further, the last end of anything is that which it strives to obtain by its operations. Now man by all his well-ordered and right operations strives to attain the contemplation of truth, for the operations of the active powers are so many preparations and dispositions to the contemplative powers. Therefore the end of man is to arrive at the contemplation of truth. For this purpose, then, was the soul united to the body, whereby a man comes into being. Therefore it is not through union with the body that the soul loses knowledge; on the contrary, it is united to the body that it may acquire knowledge. Again, if a man who is ignorant of the sciences be questioned about matters pertaining to the sciences, he will not answer the truth except as regards universal principles, which no one ignores, since they are known to all in the same way and naturally. Afterwards, however, if he be questioned consecutively, he will answer the truth about things closely connected with the principles, while bearing those principles in mind, and he will continue to do so, as long as he is able to apply the force of those principles to the matters on which he is questioned. From this, accordingly, it is clear that knowledge is caused anew in the person questioned by the first principles, and not by the remembrance of a knowledge he had possessed before. Further, if the knowledge of conclusions were as natural to the soul as knowledge of principles, all would have the same opinion about conclusions as they have of principles, since things that are natural are the same for all. Now all have not the same opinion about conclusions, but only about principles. It is therefore clear that the knowledge of principles is natural to us, but not the knowledge of conclusions. Now from that which is natural to us we acquire that which is not natural, even as in external things we make with our hands all the products of art. Therefore we have no knowledge of conclusions save that which we obtain from principles. Again, forasmuch as nature is ever directed to one thing, it follows that of one power there is naturally one object. For instance, color is the object of sight, sound of hearing. Wherefore the intellect, since it is one power, has one natural object, of which it has knowledge per se and naturally, and this object must be that under which are comprised all things known by the intellect, just as under color are comprised all colors, which are per se visible. Now this is no other than being. Therefore our intellect knows being naturally, and whatever is per se comprised under being as such, and on this knowledge is based the knowledge of first principles, such as the incompatibility of affirmation and negation, and the like. Consequently, these principles alone are known naturally by our intellect, while conclusions are known through them even as through color the sight knows both common and accidental sensibles. Further, that which we acquire through the senses was not in the soul before its union with the body. Now, knowledge of principles is caused in us from sensibles, for had we not perceived some whole by our senses, we should be unable to understand that a whole is greater than its part, just as a man born blind is unable to have an idea of colors. Neither, therefore, had the soul any knowledge of principles before its union with the body, and much less, of other things. Consequently, Plato's proof of the existence of the soul before its union with the body cannot stand. Again, if all souls existed before the bodies to which they are united, it would seem to follow that the same soul is united to different bodies according to the vicissitudes of time. In fact, this is an evident consequence of the opinion of those who hold the eternity of the world. For, if men have been begotten from eternity, it follows that an infinite number of human bodies have been begotten and corrupted during the whole course of time. Therefore, we must say either that an actually infinite number of souls pre-existed, if each soul is united to a single body, or if the number of souls be finite, that the same soul is united at one time to this, at another time to that body. And the same would seem to follow if we suppose that souls existed before bodies, but that generation was not from eternity. For although it be supposed that the begetting of men has not always been, one cannot doubt that it can be of infinite duration, because each man is so formed by nature, that unless he be accidentally hindered, he is able to beget another even as he himself was begotten of another. Yet this is impossible if, supposing a finite number of souls, one soul cannot be united to several bodies. Wherefore several who have asserted the existence of souls before bodies, maintain the transmigration of souls. But this is impossible. Therefore souls did not exist before bodies. That one soul cannot possibly be united to different bodies is proved thus. Human souls do not differ specifically from one another, but only numerically, else men also would differ in species from one another. Now numerical distinction arises from material principles. Consequently the distinction among human souls will have to be taken from something material. Not, however, as though matter were part of the soul, for it has been shown above, that the soul is an intellectual substance and that no such substance has any matter. It remains, therefore, that in the manner indicated above, the distinction and plurality of souls must be taken from their relation to the different matters to which souls are united. Consequently, if there are different bodies, they must needs have different souls united to them. Therefore one is not united to several. Again, it has been proved above, that the soul is united to the body as its form. Now forms must be proportionate to their respective matters, since they are related the one to the other as potentiality to act, for the proper act corresponds to the proper potentiality. Therefore one soul is not united to several bodies. Moreover, the power of the mover should be proportionate to its mobile, for not every power moves every movable. Now it cannot be said that the soul, even were it not the form of the body, is not its mover, for the animate differs from the inanimate by sense and movement. Therefore different souls must correspond to different bodies. Again, in things subject to generation and corruption, the same identical thing cannot be reproduced by generation, for, since generation and corruption are movements towards substance, in things that are generated and corrupted, the substance does not remain the same, as it does in things that are moved locally. Now, if the one soul is united successively to various generated bodies, the same identical man will be reproduced by generation. This is a necessary consequence for Plato, who said that man is a soul clad with a body. Follows also for all the others, because, since the unity, even as the being, of a thing follows its form, it follows that those things are one in number, whose form is one in number. Therefore it is not possible for one soul to be united to several bodies, and from this it follows also that neither were souls before bodies. The Catholic faith declares itself in agreement with this truth, for it is said in the psalm, "He who hath made the hearts of every one of them," because, to wit, God fashioned a soul for each one separately, and neither created them all together, nor united one to different bodies. Hence it is also declared in the book De Ecclesiastis Dogmatibus, "We affirm that the souls of men were not created from the beginning together with other intellectual natures, nor all at the same time, as Origen pretended." Chapter 84. Solution of the foregoing arguments. The arguments whereby it is proved that souls have existed from eternity, or that, at least, they existed before bodies, are easily solved. For the first statement, that the soul has the power to be always, must be granted, but it must be observed that the power and potentiality of a thing extend not to what has been, but to what is or will be. Wherefore possibility has no place in the past. Therefore from the fact that the soul has the power to be always, we may conclude, not that it always was, but that it always will be. Further, that to which a power is directed does not follow from the power unless the power be supposed. Hence, although the soul has the power to be always, we cannot infer that the soul is always, except after it has already received this power. And if we presume that it received this power from eternity, we shall be begging the question at issue, namely whether the soul has been from eternity. As to the second objection about the eternity of the truth which the soul understands, we must observe that the eternity of a truth understood may be taken in two ways: in one way, as to the thing understood, in another as to that whereby it is understood. If the understood truth be eternal as regards the thing understood, it follows that the thing understood is eternal, but not the one who understands, whereas if the understood truth be eternal as to that whereby it is understood, it would follow that the soul which understands it is eternal. Now the understood truth is eternal not in the latter but in the former way, for it is clear from what has been said that the intelligible species, by which our soul understands truth, are acquired by us from the phantasms through the active intellect. Hence it cannot be inferred that the soul is eternal, but that the truths understood are based on something eternal, for their foundation is in the first truth, as in the universal cause which contains all truth. But the soul is compared to this eternal thing, not as subject to form, but as a thing to its proper end, because the true is the good of the intellect and the end thereof. Now from a thing's end we can argue about its duration, just as we can argue about its beginning from its efficient cause, since what is directed to an eternal end must be capable of enduring forever. Consequently, from the eternity of intelligible truth we can prove that the soul is immortal, but not that it is eternal. That neither can the latter be proved from the eternity of the agent is clear from what has been said above, when we were discussing the eternity of creatures. The third objection, which refers to the perfection of the universe, is not cogent. For the perfection of the universe regards the species, not the individuals, since the universe is continually receiving an addition of individuals to the pre-existing species. Now human souls do not differ specifically among themselves, but only numerically, as we have proved. Consequently, it is not inconsistent with the perfection of the universe if new souls be created. Hence we may gather the reply to the fourth objection, for it is stated at the same time that God ended his work, and that he rested from all his work which he had done. Since, then, the ending or perfecting of creatures regards the species and not the individuals, so God's rest must be understood to refer to the cessation from forming new species, but not new individuals, the like of which, in the species, have existed before. Accordingly, as all human souls are of one species, even as are all men, it is not incompatible with the aforesaid rest if God creates new souls from day to day. It must, however, be observed that we do not find it stated by Aristotle that the human intellect is eternal, and yet he is wont to say this of those things which, in his opinion, always have been. But he declares that it is everlasting, and this can be said of those things that always will be, although they have not always been. Hence, in excluding the intellective soul from the conditions of other forms, he did not say that this form was before matter, and yet Plato said this of ideas, so that it would seem consistent with the subject of which he was treating that he should say something of the kind of the soul, but he said that it remains after the body. Chapter 85. That the soul is not made of God's substance. From the foregoing it is clear that the soul is not of God's substance. For it has been shown above, that the divine substance is eternal, and that nothing pertaining thereto begins anew, whereas human souls did not exist before bodies, as we have proved. The soul cannot be of the divine substance. Moreover, it was shown above, that God cannot be the form of anything, whereas the soul is the form of the body, as we have proved. Therefore it is not of the divine substance. Further, everything from which something is made is in potentiality to that which is thus made from it. But God's substance is not in potentiality to anything, for it is pure act, as we proved above. Therefore it is impossible that the soul or any other thing whatsoever be made from God's substance. Again, that from which something is made is changed in some way. But God is utterly unchangeable, as we proved above. Therefore it is impossible for anything to be made from him. Moreover, the soul shows evident signs of variation in knowledge and virtue, and their opposites, whereas in God there is no variation whatever, neither per se, nor accidental. Again, it was shown above that God is pure act, wherein there is no potentiality, whereas in the human soul we find both potentiality and act, for it contains the possible intellect which is in potentiality to all that is intelligible, besides the active intellect, as shown above. Therefore the human soul is not from the divine nature. Again, since the divine substance is altogether indivisible, the soul cannot be part thereof, but only the whole. Now the divine substance cannot possibly be but one, as we showed above. It follows, therefore, that there would be for all men only one soul as regards the intellect, and this has been refuted above. Therefore the soul is not from the divine substance. This opinion arose apparently from a triple source, for some maintained that no substance is incorporeal. Consequently they asserted that God is the most noble body, whether this be air, fire, or any other thing that they considered to be a principle, and they affirmed that the soul was of the nature of this body. For they all ascribed to the soul whatever they considered to be a principle, as Aristotle says wonder anima, and thus it followed that the soul is from the divine substance. From this root sprang the opinion of Manes, who thought that God is a bright body extending through infinite space, whereof, said he, the human soul is a fragment. But this opinion was refuted above, both because we proved that God is not a body, and because we have shown that neither the human soul nor any intellectual substance is a body. Some have maintained that for all men there is but one intellect, whether active only, or both active and possible, as stated above. Since the ancients asserted that every separate substance is God, it followed that our soul, namely the intellect whereby we understand, is of the divine nature. Wherefore even nowadays certain adherents to the Christian faith, who hold that the active intellect is a separate being, say expressly that the active intellect is God. But this opinion about the unity of our active intellect was disproved above. Possibly also, this opinion may have arisen from the very likeness of our soul to God. For it is on account of man's soul that intelligence, which is esteemed most proper to God, is found to be befitting to no substance in this lower world, save man alone. Hence it might seem that the soul was allied to the divine nature, and especially so to those men who were convinced of the human soul's immortality. Moreover, this would seem to be confirmed by the fact that after it had been said, "Let us make man to our image and likeness," it is added, "God formed man of the slime of the earth, and breathed into his face the breath of life." From which text some wished to conclude that the soul is of the divine nature, since he who breathes into another's face puts forth into another the identical thing which was in himself. And so scripture would seem to imply that God put into man something divine in order to give him life. But the aforesaid likeness does not prove that man is a part of the divine substance, for in understanding he suffers from manifold defects, which cannot be said of God. Wherefore this likeness indicates an imperfect image rather than consubstantiality. In fact scripture indicates this when it says that man was made to God's image. Hence the aforesaid breathing shows that life came forth from God into man by way of a certain likeness, and not according to identity of substance. For which reason also the spirit of life is stated to have been breathed into his face, because, since the organs of several senses are situate in this part of the body, the signs of life are more evidenced in the face. Accordingly God is said to have breathed the spirit into man's face, because he gave man the spirit of life, but not by parting it from his own substance. For he who breathes the breath of his body into the face of someone, whence the metaphor is apparently taken, blows into his face the air, but does not send forth part of his substance into him.